Just a quick survey. Anyone this time waiting for the bell to ring? Waiting for the end of the sitting? And any of you just turn your attention toward that feeling of waiting? And then what happened? You know, even at the time of the Buddha, from what I understand, of course I wasn't there, or maybe I was. Even during the time of the Buddha, there were those, I think it was a universal experience that people wanted to get to the end. In fact, there's a famous story in the numbered sutras, again, in the Anguttara Nikaya, about a deva, a so-called celestial being named Rohitasa. And Rohitasa, as a celestial being, as a deva, as often celestial beings or devas have some kind of special power that allowed them to be reborn in a deva realm, there's a realm for all the different special qualities. And this was, he was, Rohitasa the deva, his special quality was being able to move vast distances very quickly, be able to walk very fast. And having been exposed to the experience of what in the teachings is called dukkha. Dukkha isn't just translated as suffering. That's one flavor of it. But dukkha is translated as unsatisfactoriness, unreliability, insubstantiality, that which is hard to bear, the things about life that are hard to be with. He wanted to get to the end of that, of all that stuff that we deal with. And his view, and of course it was somewhat diluted, but he thought he could use his special powers to get to the end of the world. He was going to walk to the end of the world, to the end of all of the stress that befalls anyone who was born. And he could walk so fast that he could, it said he could walk so fast that he would be, his speed was faster than if someone shot an arrow at a target. He would reach the target before. So he figured, I can walk so fast, I'll walk to the end of the world and I'll get off of this whole mess of a stressful situation where things are so hard to bear and unsatisfactory. Things change, things keep just impinging on our senses over and over. We don't always get what we want, and we don't always want what we get. That there are things here that are really hard to bear, and I'm going to just walk my way to the end of it. So he walked for 100 years, and then he died. He died trying. And because he had some wholesome qualities, he was reborn into this human plane, which is the fruit of wholesome qualities. This is kind of the perfect school to get enlightened. There's things that are hard to bear, but there's also joy. There's so many things that can gladden our heart. And there's just hopefully in our lives, there's some equal measure of things that are hard to bear and things that are gladdening, that are joy-inducing. So it's considered a very wholesome birth, a very precious human birth. So he was born into human life again, and he went to see the Buddha, had the good fortune of meeting a Buddha. That's pretty incredible. And he said to Buddha, in such and such a life, I was Rohitasa, the deva, and I tried to walk to the end of the world, and And I died. He says, is it? Of course, he died at 100. It's just longer than most people live. Or he died at 100 and something, because devas live longer too, in general. But he said to the Buddha, is it possible to reach the end of the world by going? And the Buddha looked at him and said, nope. But then the Buddha said to him, only those who reach the end of the world become liberated. But then he shared the instruction that is fulfilled by our practice here, at least the way I see it. He said, within this fathom-long body, with its senses and perceptions, lies the world. Within this fathom-long body, with its senses and perceptions, lies the cause of the world that I keep spinning out. That we literally make this world with our mind. And I think it's useful to remember when we're sitting here in real time that our ideas of the world and the world are not the same. And this is also true, which I'll go into much more tomorrow, our ideas of ourself, which are historical, and ourselves are different. Our direct experience. So he said, within this fathom-long body lies the world, lies the cause of the world. Within this fathom-long body, with its senses of perceptions, lies the end of the world. The end of the world of me-making and my-making, of going. And then finally, he said, within this fathom-long body with its senses and perceptions lies the path leading to the end of the world. We associate a path with going somewhere. And what do we do in the way that we construct reality? We present it as somewhere, as where we're going is somewhere in front of us, and we call it future. And then tether our happiness, our well-being, our joy, our freedom to this place that we create in our mind called the future. And then what do? We go about waiting for it, wanting it, longing for it, not realizing that the future is an idea, that there is, as Alan Watts says, no such thing as tomorrow, in fact. The time is always now. And because our freedom and happiness and well-being is tethered to that imagined future that never arrives, our mind and body, as it sits here, is in a state of uncertainty. Because if my sense of well-being is associated with how things turn out, because it's the future is an idea, I don't know how it'll turn out. And so this way of constructing reality is a cause and condition for a feeling of increased distress, fear, worry, and a habit of going out of ourselves in an imagined state of wanting and considering the path as somewhere where we are going, rather than a place where a path is something that has been cleared, as in the sutta some places translated as denuded. So when we're waiting for the bell to ring or the end of the sitting, the end, just like the weekend, just like the whatever it is that we're looking forward to, it becomes the source of our happiness. It's systemic, part of our human condition. It's not so personal to each of us. It's all of us, to some degree, associate happiness with satisfying some kind of hunger or creating conditions that meet our expectations. Meanwhile, while we are in a state of waiting, one of the byproducts is worry, anxiety. But another byproduct is a state of tension, a state that I call that, I don't know, I came up with it years ago and it seems to fit, a state of suspended happiness, a state of kind of held in a sense, my relief and release and freedom held hostage to this uncertain future. And interestingly enough, when I'm in a, and I imagine this is true for you, when I'm in a state of, I'll just give you a story I've told on some retreats, I don't know. I had the good fortune in 1979 to buy my first home. And just listening to this price, I don't usually tell the price, but I'll tell you. It was $29,000. It's quaint by today's standards. But it was huge for me in those days. But this was a precious opportunity. I was in my 20s and was able to come up with the down payment. And then I went about the experience of home improvement. And the more I got engaged in this home improvement, the more the tension built. Until one day, there was a things falling into place, a kind of insight knowledge, a realization that home improvement is endless. And I had been waiting for the end. And there really was this sense of, I can't wait for this to be over. And there was a huge sense of release. And of course, it's the same is true for self-improvement. It's endless. So it's best that we don't fall into the project mentality. So I will practice to fix myself so that in some future date I will be okay. But we let the fixing be a byproduct of not going anywhere, not looking for anything but this. Getting back to Ryokan, Buddha is your mind, and the way goes nowhere. Don't look for anything but this. If you keep pointing your cart north when you want to go south, how will you ever arrive? This is why the walking to and fro, we arrive in each step. So you could entitle this talk, First Things First, which is be at the end of the world first, and then go about going without the demand that it has to make you happy. Find the end of the world, the end of your becoming, the end of your seeking. Find the root of your seeking. The root meaning, where does this seeking come from? Study, in other words, study the seeking mind. Notice the wanting mind. Notice the waiting for the bell to ring. Notice the desire to fix, desire to become. Of course, that's a very cultural phenomenon, this obsessed with success and measuring. I'll talk much more about that tomorrow, the measuring mind that's good, better, best, always looking for the best. There's something beautiful about refining and developing and expressing our most wholesome human qualities. But if we fall into a view of ourselves as lacking, it just sets us up for more waiting. So notice what happens in this moment when you don't look ahead and you don't look back and you don't give rise to any idea of yourself as lacking. And just sensing what's here. That's not historical. Anybody willing to say what you notice when you step out of that whole process of going? Please.
It's actually not a comment about that, but something that came to mind when you were speaking just now was a newly coined word I heard a number of years ago, and the word is anticipointment.
Anticipointment.
Yeah, which seems to lend itself to that, what you're talking
about. Great, I love it. Anticipointment. Yep, it's like an appointment with disappointment, appointment with dissatisfaction, anticipointment. So we will deconstruct this a little bit more tomorrow. But the Buddha was really interested in one thing, which is the fact that we feel this sense of angst and stress and dissatisfaction and the unreliability of our circumstances, the uncertainty of things, and that we all want to feel certainty. We all want to feel peace. So we want to be free of this mental suffering. And we want that relief. We want the end of the self-improvement project, home improvement, the end of whatever that is that gives us a feeling of relief. And that we are all in the habit of looking elsewhere for that relief. So you're already onto something. The fact that you know that it's an inside job. Yet part of our practice is to recognize what's always already available to us right now. That's partly why I asked you those questions. But part of our practice, what happens if we get used to this kind of presence of awareness, aware presence, is that we get to notice and to use as our manure of Bodhi, our fertilizer. We get to notice and use all of the tendencies of mind that, when unrecognized, tend to lead us endlessly astray in samsara's vicious cycle, Samsara is that endless wandering, endlessly looking for a future that never arrives. So two sides of practice are opening, recognizing the natural happiness of being present, that anybody, I don't care whether you've sat a day in your life, without any practice at all, you can sense something release after your last thought has ceased and before the next plan arises. Anyone can sense a little openness, a little space, a little ease. Some of these unconditional qualities that just get masked when we're busy going. They're available to us here and now. And how bright our awareness becomes when the dust of all that memory and all those plans melts away a little bit. We become much more, life becomes much more vivid the more you're here. You notice how in the quiet, how sounds, sensation, everything comes alive in a much greater way. That's just the dust of memory clearing. And we just feel the sense of immediacy. And hopefully in that process of having little one moment after another, you're getting used to it. Like we talked about earlier today, this being here, not just being in this retreat, but just being present, it just gets more interesting. And then the desire to be somewhere else or go somewhere else diminishes. That's in some ways how the practice unfolds. But the more you are here, the more that the dust of memory clears, and the more the clear mirror of your mind is laid bare, the more you see how much you run from silence. And just like Francois Fenelon said, we shouldn't be discouraged by that, as we only know our malady when the cure begins. As Bhante Guneratna says, somewhere in the process of meditation, you will come to the realization that you are completely crazy. Your mind is a shrieking madhouse on wheels barreling down the hill, utterly out of control and hopeless. It says, no problem. You're no worse than you were yesterday. It's always been this way, but you didn't notice. But each time we make that shift from being carried along by that endless search, lost in it, leaning, caught in that state of suspended happiness, every time we notice our mind doing that, we're literally aerating the power of that grasping at what's next and opening up naturally more space, the space of presence. You know, words can't capture that feeling. They only point. So the Buddha was caught in the same cycle. He tried everything. He tried having as many sensual experiences as he could have, tried all kinds had an access to a variety of sensual pleasures unsurpassed in his time, in his environment, just like our culture has found just so many ways to stimulate our senses, to give us little hits of pleasure. But he started to see something that most of you, otherwise you wouldn't be here. He started to see that, yeah, I've had tons of great experiences in my life. And I really have. I've had that trip to Costa Rica. I've had lots of travels, had lots of great retreat experiences, I've had great friends. I've had the great good company being able to serve in this role. But I started to notice that all those pleasurable experiences they tend to be short-lived. And if I depended on them, if I made pleasurable experiences my devotion, I would often feel a little bit of loss when I wasn't experiencing it. And rather than just feel loss and have it settle me into the experience of how life is, life has loss. Things are, what did the Buddha say? Everything that arises has the nature to fade away. To be in harmony with that truth brings happiness. Anicca vada sankara. You know that chant? Upaduvaya domino pakituva niruchanti esang upasamo sukho. All things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away. To be in harmony with this truth brings great happiness, brings sukha. But if we don't understand that that opening up to our loss, opening up to things that are hard to bear, recognizing the changing conditions in all the things that are difficult to be with, and normalizing it as a part of, if you're born, definition of birth, leading cause of loss. And change. And unsatisfactoriness that comes from things being changing. But if you don't know this, you keep, as I think, I always get this, I always think of Heather Martin. She came to visit this place I was at in this house at Salt Spring that had on the beams of the ceiling, all it was lined with egg beaters. And Heather gave me this old English name for them. They're like helicopter something or other. Does anybody know that word? It's a very almost old English word, helicopter something or other. They're like helicopter. But we, all of us, turn into helicopters in terms of seeking. We watch the way you eat. You put the food in your mouth, chew, 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 burst of flavor. Flavor's gone before it's even halfway down your throat. You're reaching for the other. Pretty soon, you're just going around and around and around like a helicopter, like an egg beater. And that the more we get caught in that cycle, we're not actually experiencing our life anymore. We're just seeking and never satisfied, like hungry ghosts, little mouths and huge stomachs. And again, that's not personal. That's systemic. That's culture. We live in the land of the hungry ghosts. So the Buddha was, you know, the humans were like that. So the Buddha saw that there's something wrong with this picture. But what really struck him, what became his guru, was the fact of sickness, old age, and death. He saw, okay, if you have pride and tether your happiness to youth, you'll suffer. You'll get enchanted with youth, and I noticed since I've turned, now I'm 66, but for some reason when I hit 60, that's really when the pride in youth just got zapped. It took my breath away. And the ideation about age, you know, and I have to admit it hasn't been easy. So it's not abstract. We all go through the dissolution of our pride in youth and the pride in health. And of course, life will wear you down to a certain degree. But what really helps is if you turn toward this reality and normalize it by understanding it's not just me. This is what everyone deals with. But people weren't dealing with it at the time of the Buddha. And he just said, people are... Everybody's getting sick, getting old, dying. But then they're choosing, as their means of dealing with it, experiences that also come and go. There's no rest in this. There's got to be something more to this game than just being born, having a lot of experiences that come and go, and then dying. There's no freedom in that. And it's actually planting seeds over and over of more habits of mind of seeking, but not finding. And there was nobody around to kind of give him the information about where true happiness could be found. But one thing I will leave you with before the end of the day, and we'll elaborate a little bit more tomorrow. But over the course of his own study of happiness, which is really, I think, his whole teaching, his whole practice was about happiness, being called Sukhiya, the happy one. He was not called the great sufferer, he was called the happy one. But he saw that most of us stay in this domain of looking for happiness and experiencing little moments of it, but looking for happiness of the sort that comes from getting what we want, from satisfying a hunger, or from just generally pleasant experience. And he called that kind of happiness that has so many, that is so beautiful in a way, this temporary happiness, because there's so many beautiful flavors of it. One of them, one of the kinds of worldly happiness is us being together, the pleasure of good company, the pleasure of relationships, the pleasure of sights and sounds and smells and tastes, all beautiful things that gladden our heart. But these are also pleasurable moments or moments of happiness that depend on conditions being a certain way. And consequently, all of these beautiful experiences that we have together are subsumed under the Buddha's teaching that these are dukkha. These are dukkha in the sense of unreliable and unsatisfactory, because they come and go, and they leave in their wake the desire for more. We called this kind of happiness, called it worldly happiness, happiness that comes through gladdening our senses. And this kind of pleasure, really great, and those who don't live wholesome lives, kusala lives, that lives of non-harming, lives of generosity, lives of gratitude, can't experience even simple sense pleasures. The whole world, it seems much more bleak. So it's really a fruit of living a good life that you can actually enjoy, have the happiness of sense pleasures. But even so, this kind of worldly happiness, the Buddha says, was subsumed under dukkha. And even, I'll elaborate more on this tomorrow, even great meditative experiences, because they change, are subsumed under the umbrella of dukkha, not reliable. Where does that leave us? But yet, the great meditative experiences are the fruit of not being so inundated in seeking that your mind and body can come together in quiet and harmony. So it's a fruit of something wholesome. Just like ordinary sense pleasures are the fruit of living a non-harming life, it's the proximate cause of being able to enjoy the world, is living a blameless life to the extent possible. So these are all very wholesome things, but yet still not reliable. But then what happened to the Buddha, and I'll elaborate a little more tomorrow, is that he, in the course of his study, practice, he realized, after trying to find it in all these changing conditions, something in him, when he saw that it wasn't possible, something in him let go. And as he let go a little, he started to feel more peaceful. As he let go a lot, he started to feel a lot more peace. Like Ajahn Chah says, if you let go a little, you have a little peace. Let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you have complete peace and freedom. But in a flash of insight, he had an awakening to that in him that was not conditioned by anything, and experienced what he called not worldly happiness, which is called Lokiya Sukha, but transcendental happiness, which he called Lokuttara Sukha, unstuck from the world, a well-being that was beyond the power and influence of whatever was going on, that would sustain itself during highs, lows, and in-betweens. And recognize that this is the end of dukkha. This is the highest happiness, the happiness of the unconditioned. And it basically suggested that we all aim for this highest happiness. I'm giving the short version. With the understanding is that we don't really give up all those other worldly things. We just understand more deeply that they go away. And in fact, all these other worldly pleasures come in the wake of that, of aiming for the highest happiness. And where do you find the highest happiness? Somebody tell me. How far do you have to travel? So this is a recommendation tonight, since we're at the end of our day, to don't stray away from this tonight. Keep your mind in your body in your mind. Don't let your mind leave your body, because your body's always here. No matter where you go, there you are. And so consider yourself in this evening on retreat, and no matter how far you wander, you're only a split second from this ever-present wakefulness and clarity, ever available. And if you get confused at all, go through a mood swing or whatever, that's understandable. You're a little more opened up. But just ask yourself, is there awareness here? What am I aware of? And what's the attitude of mind? Is my mind colored by the poisons that will make me think I can't be happy here? I can't be okay here. That's the three poisons. Once they become objects of mindfulness, oh, this is the wanting mind, this is the aversive mind, then they become the manure of our practice. So you have all evening. It may seem like a long time between now and tomorrow, but just keep a cover of mindfulness. Sit if you can. Don't even consider rolling over and going back to sleep tomorrow. Really consider that your practice is not just for yourself, but to support others. And try to find some pleasure in that thought of knowing that you're supporting others. Each person here really does have a huge impact. Don't underestimate your power. And of course, the way we enhance that power is to really charge yourself with that vitality that comes from mindful presence. So enjoy the evening. It was wonderful to be with you today.